Hello, I'm James Dobson, and I want to discuss some of the questions that parents ask most frequently. If you're a parent or a guardian of children, I think you'll find this program interesting and helpful.
Dr. Dobson, we've received many letters which ask for assistance with very specific aspects of parenthood. So we thought it would be helpful to devote this program to some of those common difficulties.
I think that'd be a very practical use of this time, Flo. But before we do that, I just want to tell you you're uniquely qualified for what you're doing here because being a mother, you've experienced many of the things we're talking about in the home. And also your Christian perspective and the femininity and all the things you bring are appreciated. And I just wanted to take this moment to say so.
Oh, thank you, Jim. It's my privilege to have a part in this. And I feel that the Lord, in a unique way, led me to this position and gave me this opportunity because the outcome of the Christian family is very dear to my heart. I thank the Lord for a happy Christian family and all he's given me there. And I'm happy to have this opportunity to share in your ministry.
Now, just what in the world was that question that you asked me? We were dealing with...
Kind of goes to the mundane from here, because the question's bedwetting. And that's a terribly frustrating subject to mothers of small children. What about the cause? What causes a child to continue wetting the bed at 4 or 6 or 8 years of age?
Well, Flo, the technical name for that is enuresis, and it can be caused by different factors in different children. It's kind of like a fever, you know, it's just a symptom, and then you have to deal with the cause, which is below that. But it can result from physiological considerations, such as an inadequate bladder size or urinary problems or what have you. A second causative factor has to do with the depth of a child's sleep, which often occurs in an immature child and also in a boy more often than a girl. There are 4 stages of sleep that human beings go into, and not everybody goes into the 4th stage. Each stage is progressively deeper than the ones that preceded it. The 4th stage is the deepest sleep, and it is the closest we come to death in our lives because all of the physiological processes of the body slow way on down in that 4th stage. And it's so deep that little children don't hear or respond to the reflex, the signal that indicates they need to urinate. And so it just is missed. And for that reason, obviously, they do something they wish they didn't and hadn't done and regret when they wake up, but it's absolutely involuntary.
Well, could enuresis be caused from emotional problems in some cases? Can it also produce emotional problems in a child? I can see with what you said here that the guilt associated with that would be terrible.
Yes, it can not only be caused by emotional problems, but it can cause emotional problems. It goes both ways. Mm-hmm. In fact, any emotional stress in the young years will produce a greater incidence of bedwetting. For example, when camp directors have their little campers there for the first time, the first time they've been away from home, they would be wise to put rubber sheets on all the beds because they're going to have a lot of what's called midnight sailors. You know? So that's just part of it. Any greater degree of stress will usually increase the possibility of bedwetting in a small child. It does not mean that every child who wets the bed has great emotional problems, but it does mean that emotions and... Well, let me put it another way. Someone said that there's such a close relationship between the mind and the body that one usually catches the ills of the other. Mm. So it goes both ways. If you have stress emotionally, it will often reflect itself physically and vice versa as well. Now, in the second half of what you asked, bedwetting can also produce emotional problems in a child who didn't have them otherwise. Anything that brings embarrassment and ridicule to a child can be destructive to his self-esteem. And self-esteem is the core of the personality. Anything that touches the worth of a child and makes him feel foolish and incredibly dumb and different and unacceptable hurts. It hurts deeply and it leaves scars, and that's what emotional distress is all about. Waking up in the middle of the night soaked, having to go tell the parents who may or may not take well to being awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning and told that this has occurred again and again and again, and mother knows she's got to wash 4 blankets and a pillow and 2 sheets and a mattress, and the tendency to explode at a child. Or even if you don't do that, he feels his own embarrassment,
yes,
and, you know, the rejection that comes from knowing that you've done something to displease those closest to you. Probably the worst part of it is being laughed at by siblings.
Mm-hmm.
They point their finger at you the next morning and say, ha ha, and you're still a baby, and so on. That can put a child under a great deal of stress.
Well, should a parent punish a child for wetting the bed?
Absolutely not. Categorically not, unless the child wakes up and then just lays there because he's too lazy to go to the bathroom, and you're absolutely sure that it's an intentional thing. You should never punish any child at any time for any involuntary act, even if it's involuntarily flunking a spelling test. If he can't help it, then he should not be held accountable for it, any more than I should throw somebody in jail for doing something that they didn't mean to do. When punishment is appropriate is when it is for willful disobedience and defiance. And wetting the bed at 3 o'clock in the morning in that deep, deep sleep is not in that category. And you really set the child up for problems if you violate that principle.
I can understand that. What's the best form of treatment, then?
Fortunately, there's a rather simple, straightforward approach to the problem, which can be highly effective in many cases. The information as to the effectiveness of this approach is not very well known. But Sears Roebuck and Company has a system, a device, I'm sure other companies do, I'm just not familiar with them, called a We Alert, which is a rather appropriate name. And its purpose is to train that reflex mechanism to awaken a child. See, the reflex is there saying you need to go to the bathroom, but the child doesn't hear it.
I see.
The mind doesn't respond to it. Now, this device is an electrical system, which is run by a battery, so there's no danger to it, which makes a very loud noise in the middle of the night when the moisture makes a connection between a metal pad that's on the bottom and a porous metal pad on the top with something in between that the urine can go through. When that connection is made, it rings the buzzer. It's a terrible noise, loud noise, a very irritating noise, and it awakens the child, and it'll buzz until he does get up and turn it off. Now, what most people don't know is that that will not cure the problem just by having him get up and turn it off. The next morning, he won't even remember having gotten up and turned off the buzzer. In order for this to work, there has to be what's called an aversive stimuli, something that he does not want, something that he wishes wouldn't happen, some reason not to want that buzzer to go off, other than that he has to get up and turn it off. And that aversive stimuli can be, and probably should be, having the child come in and wake you up as a parent, which is difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know. But if you're going to conquer this thing, you got to put something
in it. Work together.
Incidentally, that can produce some amazing arguments at 3 o'clock in the morning between mother and father as to who's going to get up and do the job. But you take the child in, and you tell him that this is not for punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing this to you for punishment. This is to help you, so that you won't have this problem anymore, and so you can invite friends over to your house, and so you can go to other people's houses. And you put him in a tub of cool water. Not ice cold, but cool water. Or, at the very least, splash cold water in his face.
Hmm.
Now, that's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody hates that, and the child hates it, and he fights it. But what it is saying to his mind is, I don't want that to happen anymore. And so he begins to associate that sound of that buzzer and the way he was feeling at the moment he relaxed and urinated with the aversive stimuli, the cold water. And you can train him to hear the reflex. You can train him to tune into it. You can teach that reflex to respond. It may take as much as 3 or 4 weeks or even 5 for it to work. With our child, who had a perpetual bedwetting problem at 5 years of age, wet the bed 5 nights a week at least, if not 7, that's which can be very frustrating for parents,
yes,
I might say. Within the first week, he stopped.
Really?
So it can really be effective if you're willing to carry through with it, and the child can start to hear the reflex. By doing this, you don't have to punish. You don't have to restrict water at night, the intake of water. You don't have to get him up during the night. In fact, you must not, because that doesn't train the reflex. He can go to the bathroom and not even wake up and then start dreaming that he's in there. So it's better not to wake him up. And it's really the best way to help a child who's developmentally immature come of age in regard to nighttime control.
What would be the youngest age you would use this?
I don't think you would use it under four. Before that, you're just not surprised at a bedwetting problem. After four, you can expect the child to come around. And I think it's important, too, to have a very positive attitude toward this and to not act like he's got this awful dread problem, you know, tantamount to cancer or something. You treat it as though, well, a lot of kids have this problem. We'll help you get over it. It's no problem. You know, so that he doesn't build up anxiety over it. The name of the device, again, is the Wii Alert. I think it costs about $35. And after you've solved your problem with it, you can probably get about $30 from another parent who'd like to do the same thing. I didn't design the system. It wasn't my idea. I don't get any royalty from it. And that's not why I'm sending people to Sears. I just happen to know that it works.
Yes, having tried it.
Yes.
I'm sure the parents of perpetual anuretics will find that information very helpful. Dr. Dobson, let's turn to another common problem of childhood having to do with youngsters who throw temper tantrums.
Yes, that is a common problem, Flo, and there are essentially two kinds of temper tantrums. At least they are motivated by two separate feelings on the part of the child. The first is a genuine release of emotion occurring from frustration or irritation or even from fatigue. You know, when a child is just worn out, he'll sometimes just go all to pieces and cry and scream and throw what looks like a temper tantrum. This variety, I think, is less common than the second type, and the one that I'm more concerned with, which represents a kind of parental manipulation, where a child is using this as a tool to get you to do what he wants you to do. Now, willful defiance is very common with a child this age, with a two-year-old, and you just expect it, and you're not going to change it immediately. But I think I can best illustrate this aspect of a temper tantrum by my own daughter. When she was 2 years of age, she had never thrown a temper tantrum. Not because she was too good to throw a temper tantrum, but because it never occurred to her. You know, somebody's got to suggest that idea. And when she was two, we invited some friends to our house who also had a two-year-old who was much more advanced in this regard than my daughter. And while she was there, this little two-year-old put on a marvelous demonstration for our little girl. She threw a temper tantrum that had all of the ingredients. She stamped her feet and screamed and pulled her hair and spit, fell on the floor, cried, banged her hands, banged her head on the floor, and it was quite a scene. And my daughter was absolutely awestruck. That had to be the neatest idea that she had ever heard of. And Shirley, my wife, was watching her. And she said later that night, "That's going to come back to haunt me." Because she said, "I could see Danae filing that away for future use." Well, less than 24 hours later, Danae found some flimsy, phony excuse to try to throw a temper tantrum. But the funny thing was, you know, it takes a great deal of coordination to throw a good temper tantrum, and she couldn't get it all together. She knew that she was supposed to stamp her feet and scream, because those were the two things that she recalled. But she could not do them both at one time. She would stamp her feet and look down at them, and then look up and yell. And it was the phoniest, most obvious attempt by that little child to take a new tool, a new device, and use it to get her way and to get her will with her mother. So we discouraged it in rather obvious ways, and it didn't last very long.
That's really interesting. What should a parent do when this second kind of temper tantrum occurs?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to recognize that most of those kinds of behaviors are learned. They are not inborn. A child learns how to interact socially, how to use a tool like that for his own purpose. So the most important thing is to not let it succeed. Anything that succeeds will recur. For example, if you put a child in bed at night and he cries softly, and you've got friends there and you ignore his crying softly, and he cries a little louder and a little louder and a little louder, and finally, 45 minutes later, he is virtually screaming. And finally, you're embarrassed about that, and you know the other friends are hearing it, and you go get him and you let him up. What have you taught him?
Mm-hmm.
You've taught him that it does not pay to cry softly.
Yes.
It pays to cry loudly, and you make a screamer out of your child. So I think it's important not to let any of those kinds of behaviors succeed in terms of what it is the child is trying to do in the way of manipulation. If you're going to leave, and he's being left with an uncle or nan or grandmother, you go ahead and leave. You don't let it succeed. But also, sometimes it's appropriate when you're sure that it's not a function of fatigue or other factors, but it is just a real willful display. A little swat on the legs with a switch will sometimes discourage a future performance of that nature.
It's interesting that you mentioned the use of a switch here. Was there a reason you didn't recommend that the parent swat with a hand?
Well, that shows one of my biases, Flo, and you picked up on it. I'm really in favor of the hand being an object of love. When you slap a child suddenly, or he never knows when he's going to get cracked behind the ear with your hand, then every time he's near you, that possibility exists. And if you suddenly scratch your head, he's got to fall backwards because he, you know, has to flinch. I think it's better that the hand remain an object of love, and if it is necessary in those unusual circumstances to spank or to use a little switch, it's better to have a neutral object to do it with.
That's a very nice thought. I don't think I've ever heard that expressed before, but the hand being an object of love, that's helpful.
I think it's just a way of separating the two and not use it as an object of punishment.
Well, we have more questions. Dr. Dobson, we receive quite a bit of mail with regard to the impact of television on the home and how it can be controlled without dictatorial rules and regulations. Do you have some suggestions for parents on this concern?
Flo, I always appreciate receiving that question from parents, and it does come very frequently in the mail because it shows that parents are aware of the potential harm that can come from unsupervised television watching in the home. And this is a very real concern because television literally has the power to destroy Christian values in the younger generation. Now, that may sound like an overstatement, but I really believe it. Yet I saw some statistics the other day which just absolutely amazed me, that something on the order of 50% of children have no restrictions at all on what they watch or how many hours they spend each day in front of the tube.
Oh,
and I see that as the crime. In fact, parents often encourage television watching in their young children, in the formative years, the toddlers I'm talking about, those between, say, 2 and 5, because it's a frustrating time of life for a mother, particularly. The child is always under her feet, and the easiest thing to do is to just put the child in front of the television set to kind of occupy his mind, if you want to call it that.
Mm.
And I think this is a great mistake. Someone said that if television viewing is an addictive drug, then parents are the pushers.
Oh,
and that's a strong statement, and that heaps a lot of guilt on us. But considering the filth that's offered by the networks today, and there's no other word for it, I think that it's just an unforgivable assault on a young mind to let a little child watch an unlimited assortment of violence and, quote, mature, unquote, subject matter. And a lot of that goes on, you know, because nobody's home to supervise. Both parents may work, and the child's at home just watching whatever comes on. And I think that if that was the case in my home, I'd get rid of the television set. If I can't control it, then it's not going to be there. Now, getting specifically to the question that was asked regarding how to control television in our homes, I mean, it's one thing to say that it ought to be controlled. It's another thing to say, how are we going to do that? It seems that we have three objectives as parents. First, we want to limit what our children watch. Secondly, we want to influence how much television they see. Too many good programs have an influence on the rest of the life, the free time, the personal interaction in the family. And yet, thirdly, we should hope to let the kids play a role in establishing those limits. So, as your question implied, we don't become dictatorial and inflexible. Because if you get that way, children will find a way to watch it. They'll go to a neighbor's home or they'll do something to subvert that kind of inflexible authority. So I'm speaking here now of the child in the elementary school years or older to get him involved in that decision-making process. Now, one system that I heard about recently was very effective in accomplishing all three of these purposes. First, sit down with the family and select a list of approved programs that are appropriate for a given age level.
And then type that list, or at least write it clearly and enclose it in clear plastic so it can be referred to, kind of as a reference page of the programs that we do accept. Secondly, buy a roll of tickets, which you can get without too much difficulty. If you don't want to pay for that, you can make tickets. And issue each child 10 tickets per week. And he can use those tickets to buy the privilege of watching the programs on the approved list. You see? Mm-hmm. And when his tickets are gone, then his television viewing is gone for that week, and he has to wait till next week. So it teaches him to pick and choose carefully what he does want to spend his time on. 10 hours a week is perhaps a good target to shoot at, considering the fact that the average preschool child, I'm told, watches 54 hours of television a week. Now, that's far, far, far too much, even for an elementary school child with the school activities, neighborhood activities, and so on. Select what you think is a fair amount of time and then issue those tickets. Now, this system can be modified to fit individual home situations or circumstances. If there's a special program on that all children like a Charlie Brown special or something of that nature, during Christmas and Thanksgiving and during the holidays, there are programs for children. You can issue more tickets or even issue a special ticket for a special program or something of that nature. You can make it fit your own system. But the real test, Flo, and you and I know this, is whether parents have the courage to put themselves on that system, too. Because we often need some regulations in our viewing time as well.
It's always easier to say, do as I say, rather than do as I do, isn't it?
Sure it is. And sometimes I think we expect more of our kids than we're willing to deliver ourselves, which is not really fair. And this may mean that Dad will have to give up Dandy Don and Howard Cosell and Monday Night Football and all the other things that he cares about on the tube as well. At least limit it. Not give it up, but limit it. That's our purpose with television.
Well, that ticket idea is really an innovative way to handle the problem of television. Let's take another question of relevance to an increasing number of parents having to do with adoption. First, how can parents tell the child that he was adopted when he was a baby?
You're right, Flo, in saying that adoption is becoming much more common, even though it's difficult to obtain a Caucasian child, or at least a Caucasian infant today. And in some parts of the country, it's almost impossible to obtain one. But it is very important to handle properly this message of adoption and its meaning for the child, because self-worth, or the lack of it, often gets all tangled up in the issue and the way it's conveyed. So let me offer about 4 guiding principles that may be helpful in this regard. Incidentally, I discuss this matter in greater detail in my book, The Strong-Willed Child. First of all, begin telling your adopted child of his adoption before he understands the meaning of the words. In that way, you'll avoid the problem of putting it off, and the child is getting older and older, and then you get tense over it, and then there's no appropriate moment, and you begin to panic and tie up over it, and before you know it, you have a youngster who's 3, 4, and 5, and has not been let in on this secret. And it can be a disaster to have a neighborhood child or a church child or somebody in the family break this news to him in children's characteristically unsympathetic way to a 10 or 11 or 12 or 14-year-old child. That's a disaster emotionally. And I've never seen that done without some scars that stay with a child for a good while. So begin talking to him about it very early in life. In fact, I think it's very helpful, Flo, to create a little story. It'll have to be true, obviously, but create a story. Build the facts into a story that give him an understanding of what took place and saturate it with love. Say, if this is true, and the circumstances will vary, we had a little girl, and she was 5 years old, and that was your older sister, and we wanted a little boy. And so we went to the Lord, and we began praying to him for a little boy. And we said, Lord, send us a boy. Send us a baby boy. We want a little boy that looks like our family, a little boy that would fit in. We need somebody to love. We need a boy. But the Lord didn't send us a boy. And we waited, and we prayed, and we waited. And then one day the telephone rang, and we answered the phone, and they said, we have your son. He is here. Come down and get him, and you can adopt him. Use the word adopted, not in a frightening, fearful way, not like this is some skeleton in the closet. Use it with warmth and excitement. And we couldn't believe it, and we were so happy, and we went down there, and there you were, the very child we asked for, and they were going to let us adopt him. See, and begin building in this excitement. And all the family came over, and everybody was so glad to see you. And they were all fighting to hold you and hold you close. And we were all so excited. We had a big dinner, and your sister was there, and she was so excited. You see, you begin giving a child a concept of that beginning rather than sitting down and saying, Johnny, there's something that I've been meaning to tell you, and I don't know how to say this, and I hope it isn't going to hurt you, but I've really got something to convey. And, you know, it's all in the way you can convey it.
Sure.
A child is amazingly sensitive to picking up any hidden anxiety or reluctance on your part, and I would rehearse it in those early days before his understanding of the words is complete so that it becomes natural. You just let him sort of grow up with that story. Mm-hmm. And I've found that children who are told this kind of story of their adoption want to hear it over and over and over again because it's a message of love and acceptance and identity within the family.
And it is so special. It should be easy to share that.
Absolutely. It's an exciting event. I said there were four suggestions. The second suggestion is to celebrate two birthdays for that child, the actual date of birth and then the date that he joined your family.
Oh.
And again, use the word adopted generously. Don't be afraid to use it. Don't be afraid of that word. This is the day you were adopted. That's why we're celebrating today. Now, if you have two or more children in the family and one or more of the others was a child biologically born to those parents, to you, then those children have kind of an emotional advantage in knowing they came from mother and daddy and the adopted child didn't. So this kind of tips the scales back in the direction of the adopted child. He gets two birthdays and they only get one.
So you don't worry about, since they have an advantage already, you don't worry about the effect of the second birthday, the effect that it would have on them.
No, I think it's a good way of balancing the scale again and giving him something to be proud of and excited about. And I think it's just another way of saying you are wanted, you are loved, you are needed here. Thirdly, tell him every story that you can think of where adoption fits into the story in the early years, such as the story of Moses being adopted by Pharaoh's daughter and then what great things Moses did, how he was chosen by God to lead the children of Israel. And any other story like that that you come across that gives status to the role of adoption, I think, can be helpful to head off any emotional concern that might be associated with it. And fourthly, once the foundation is laid and the word adoption is diffused, then forget it. Don't constantly remind the child of his difference. See, don't bring it up again as a skeleton in the closet. Once he understands it and his questions are answered, let it rest until it comes up naturally. But don't make him think that you think it is a constant big deal in your mind. Again, I'm amazed at how a 5 or 6 or 7-year-old child in his immaturity, in his childishness, can perceive genuine emotional ingredients of this nature. They can sort it out. They couldn't explain it to you. But if you're uptight over something, they will know it and pick it up and react to it.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that suggestion, but I see how important it is. Well, what should you tell your child about his biological parents?
There are several viewpoints on that by the various authorities. I saw an article in this a while back that was written by a Dr. Milton Levine. And he said there are three possibilities. One, tell the child his biological parents are dead. Secondly, state plainly that the biological parents were unable to care for their baby themselves. Or three, tell the child nothing is known about the biological parents, but that he was secured from an agency dedicated to finding good homes for babies. Now, of these three alternatives, Dr. Levine recommended that parents tell the child that the parents are dead, and then he'll be free to love the mother and father without guilt and without worrying about where his real parents are. In other words, Dr. Levine was suggesting that you lie to your children.
I was wondering what you were going to say.
Yes, and I'm opposed to that. I will never deliberately lie to my children or anybody else if I can avoid it. And I think there are great hazards with that. You lie to your children about this subject, and a few years later, they'll find out you weren't lying. Eventually, that'll come back to haunt you, as all lies do. Mark Twain said liars have to have a lot better memory than those who tell the truth. And that lie will eventually be exposed, and then the whole superstructure crumbles.
Yes.
Because the child can't believe what you told him about this, therefore, can he believe any other aspect to it? I think it's much better to give the child some vague but inoffensive possibilities like this. Jack, I really don't know why the woman who gave birth to you couldn't keep you. We don't know. Maybe she didn't have a home. Maybe she didn't have a bedroom or a nursery for you. Maybe she didn't have a crib. Maybe she didn't have a husband to go out and earn a living and to take care of your needs. Maybe you would have been hungry there. Maybe you wouldn't have gotten what you needed there. Maybe she was ill. See, we really don't know. We don't know what the circumstances was. I'm sure that she loved you, but we don't understand it. All that we know was that we prayed for you, and God heard that prayer, and he gave you to us, and we just thank him every day. It was his greatest gift to us. And so we just don't understand much about how you got here. All we know is we're glad you're here.
How do you feel about the current pressure to connect adopted children with biological parents?
I'm very concerned about that. I think state legislatures are considering some maneuvers that could be very harmful. And there's a lot of attention given in the press to this. It's almost a movement to connect the biological parents with the child. If a grown individual wants to find his biological parents on his own, then that's his business, and it's not my business to tell him he shouldn't do that or shouldn't have that need or that desire. I am very concerned about any movement which would help the biological parents identify the adoptive parents and appear at the front door and demand visiting rights. That is incredible, and yet I've heard that proposed.
Dr. Dobson, our third question is, when should a teenager begin to go out on unsupervised and unchaperoned dates?
That's a very emotional question, Flo, and one that's a matter of opinion. And I can only give my view on that subject, which may or may not be relevant to each family and every child. So let me just throw out how I would approach the problem. As a matter of fact, I did that in my book, The Strong-Willed Child. And I dealt there with a 14-year-old who was trying to go out on dates and trying to get permission to go out with a 17-year-old boy. And how does the parent deal with it? This is the way I suggested, and let me quote. Rather than stamping your foot and screaming no, and that's semi-final, as many parents do, I would suggest that you sit down with your daughter and work out a reasonable plan for the years ahead and a rationale to support it. You might say, Margretta, you're 14 years old, and I understand your new interest in boys. That's the way it's supposed to be. However, you're not ready to handle the pressures that an older boy can put on a girl your age. And, of course, I think you should explain what you mean there if she asks for that information. Your dad and I want to help you get ready for dating in the future, but there are some in-between steps you need to take. You have to learn how to be friends with boys before you can become a lover with one. To do this, you should get acquainted in groups of boys or girls your age. We'll invite them over to our house, or you can go to the homes of others. Then when you are between 15 and 16, you can begin double dating to places that are chaperoned by adults. And finally, you can go out on single dates sometime during your 16th year. That's our plan. Now, your dad and I want you to date and have fun with boys, and we intend to be reasonable about this. But you're not ready to plunge into single dating with a high school senior at this time, and we'll just have to find other ways to satisfy your social needs. So you're being reasonable and understanding, and you're working out a plan so they can see it coming, but where you're not letting a 14-year-old just plunge into all of the intricacies of single dating, particularly with an older boy.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, Dr. Dobson, and perhaps most importantly, there's one question that we are asked by mail almost every week, and it goes something like this. My wife and I are new Christians, and we now realize that we raised our kids by the wrong principles. They're teenagers now and are into drugs or alcohol, and we feel terribly guilty for our failures as parents. Is there anything we can do at this late date? What can you say to depressed mothers and fathers like that?
There's hardly a parent alive who does not have some regrets and painful memories of their failure as a mother or father. And I mean that, hardly a one, because children are infinitely complex. And we cannot be perfect parents any more than we can be perfect human beings. The pressures of living are often enormous, and we get tired, and we get irritated, and we get physically ill, and we don't always say the right things. We don't always do the right things. We don't always handle our children as unemotionally as we wish we had. And it's very easy a year or 2 years or 3 years later to look back and see how wrong we were in the way we approached a problem, how biased we were. All of us experienced that. And no one does the job perfectly. Let's put that in neon lights. And the parents who write the letters that you're talking about have to do the same thing that the rest of us do. And that's to go to the Lord and say, Lord, you know my inadequacies. You know my weaknesses, not only in parenting, but in every other area of my life. I'm not perfect. I'm doing the best job I can. Take my meager effort and break the fishes and the loaves and feed the 5,000. Make up for the things that I do wrong. Be there in that delicate moment when my child stands at the crossroads and can go either way. Satisfy the needs that I have not satisfied. Wrap your great arms around my children and draw them close to you and make up for what I've done wrong. And all I can do is the best I can do, and the rest is up to you. And I submit my children and myself and my job as a parent to you with my open hands and just ask you to take it and make something out of it. I think that's all we can do. And the kind of guilt that this letter and these dozens of letters express is a dead-end street. It leads nowhere. You can't change it. You can't go back and relive those years. Give it to God and let him have it.
That's an important message of hope and encouragement. Give it to God and let him have it.
That's not only all we can do, Flo. That's the very best thing we can do.
Yes.